This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Anyway, I'm glad that you all can be here. If you have some background with my teaching, you will know that I don't try to be, you know, extremely erudite and academic. I want to do good work as a philosopher, but I don't think we have to take ourselves terribly seriously or be very, you know, stuffed shirt about our academic performance. But it is necessary that our academic performance be glorifying to the Lord. I don't mind having a disagreement with someone at all. Like you, however, I do tend to get a little perturbed when people who have not thought things through get very dogmatic and arrogant and start using vocabulary that is cutting or, now sometimes if you've got a bad argument, maybe you deserve to be cut down, but when people who have not thought through the issue start acting that way, then I tend to say, well, maybe a little stronger form of refutation is called for, if I can put it mildly. I do believe that the truth of the gospel is the sort of thing which is worth dying for, and I believe that's not just because we have some volitional commitment, but because without the truth of the gospel, men would not simply be lost eternally, they'd be lost in terms of their intellect and their ability to understand this world. To the degree that men understand this world and can operate successfully at all in this world, they are depending upon the good gifts of God and the grace of God. And when people who have been recipients of God's grace start then being arrogant about God and offering arguments against God or trying to ridicule the gospel and so forth, I don't believe it's inappropriate for us to come back, not as though we shouldn't be, you know, gentle and courteous, but I think that the form of argument by which we encounter or answer those questions and ridicule, I think, should be of top-notch, full nuclear strength stuff. And so don't mistake the strength of an argument for, you know, personal animosity or, you know, well, Dr. Bonson, or if it's one of you, is just, you know, in a bad mood or something. But sometimes arguments are not just bad as arguments. You know, somebody might have an argument for why the post office should, you know, carry the mail. And I really feel strongly that all the evidence indicates not only in terms of past performance, but also the way in which the government operates and what its moral prerogatives are, that we ought not to have the post office carrying the mail. But I can understand when somebody makes a mistake on that sort of thing. You know, it's not a life and death issue. I mean, so they've misperceived the facts or the moral principles, that sort of thing. That doesn't bother me. But when it does come to the question of where we came from, how we're to live our lives, you know, what the Lord Jesus Christ did, you know, in securing our salvation, people who argue against that are not just making a passing academic mistake. This is something that calls for very strong refutation. And I'm going to attempt to give it. Sometimes I'm not always successful, but that's what I'm going to attempt to do. And I want you to join me in doing that in this seminar, because we're dealing with someone, in the case of Michael Martin, who not only is a, well, he's not just a garden variety unbeliever. Okay, there are plenty of people who don't have faith in Christ. All right? And we want to evangelize them. We want to get the word to everyone in the world that hasn't heard the gospel, hasn't yet believed the gospel, and so forth. But you know as well as I do that there are some people who lack faith, and there are other people who lack faith, and they also want to argue that they should lack that faith. Okay? You may have a next-door neighbor or a colleague at work that's in that situation. But then beyond that, there are not just people who offer reasons why they can't be Christians or why they can't believe the Bible or they don't think God exists. There are some people who actually make a living of doing this. They're ordinarily people that are employed in secular universities and so forth, not just the philosophy department, but they do tend to aggregate there, people who will argue against the faith as well. And then on top of that, I'm adding levels of insult to the Lord, I think you can see. On top of that, there are people who not only make a living at a job where they have the opportunity to spew forth their negativity about God or the gospel and so forth. There are people who go on campaigns to make sure that people know what their reasons are and so forth. And then of those who campaign, there are those who publish their opposition. Are you getting a feel of where I'm going with this? Michael Martin, oh, I didn't bring the other book down just yet, but that's a pretty thick book for anybody to publish on anything. And he spent a lot of time working at this sort of thing. There is a very strong animus against believing in God, particularly the Christian God, that Michael Martin has demonstrated. Okay, now, one of the questions we're going to want to ask ourselves as we go through his material and kibitz about it is, has his performance as a philosopher, as someone who has argued, been commensurate with what is obviously a very strong personal commitment? You know, he's not just doing this because, you know, there's a gap out there, no one said anything pro or con about God, so I'll throw out some ideas for consideration. I mean, he's campaigning, and he's trying to deal with, I mean, to his credit, he's trying to deal with what he thinks are the strongest arguments, pro and con. And he's obviously made it clear that he thinks the negative arguments are better ones, and the strong ones that are on the positive side, he thinks he can overcome. So he's done a lot of work in writing a book like this. And then, of course, there's a follow-up book that deals not with theism in general, but specifically with the claims of Christianity. It's my hope that in our seminar, we'll take today and tomorrow primarily on this book, and then the last day will be given to the smaller book on the specific claims about Christianity. That's just a rough and ready bus driver's notice as to where I think we're going. That's what I hope we'll be able to do. Okay, so you know a little bit about me and about my own convictions. Most of you who have studied with me before know that I believe that the presuppositional approach to defending the faith is not only the soundest philosophically, but it's true to the scriptures. I think it's more faithful to the need to subordinate ourselves to the Lord Jesus Christ in all that we do, including our thinking, than our somewhat popular views in evangelical circles that have been labeled evidentialist approaches to defending the faith. I certainly believe there are evidences. Anybody who was at last weekend's conference, or if you're coming this weekend to San Diego, know that I'm not at all adverse to getting down and dirty with the details. You want to talk the facts? Let's talk the facts. But I also believe, and we're going to see that demonstrated, I think, here, that the way in which people deal with the facts is governed by their underlying presuppositional commitments. And when all said and done, you can have the best factual argument you can present, and people will still have good academic reasons, if they so choose, to evade the force of what you're presenting. And so presuppositionalism goes a bit beyond that and says, and now we're going to corner them philosophically so that they have to stand still and feel the force of all those facts and details that we were bringing to their attention. And so let me see if I can put up on the board here a few notions of what I think you should get out of our seminar if you're listening closely. As we evaluate the two books by Michael Martin, I want you to, first of all, see, I'm not going to have just one section of the course on this, that's why I'm announcing it ahead of time. So as you're going over this, keep thinking about this, that presuppositions have determinate function in an argument. And I underline the word function. We need to realize that everyone's thinking, reasoning, argumentation, dialogue, functions in the way the presuppositionalists describe it. And this stands over against what I think is a fairly naive epistemology that most evidentialists have in apologetics. Don't get me wrong, I love my evidentialist brothers, and they do a lot of good work and offer us a lot of help. But they sometimes have, I think, a naive theory of knowledge whereby you can lay in brick by brick by brick, you know, certain facts that are supposed to be, you know, probably true, and with a high degree of probability, probably true. And so finally the building or the edifice of knowledge is built up and it becomes like an unavoidable case for Christianity. But presuppositions are not being taken into account in that brick-by-brick view. We're going to see when we talk about religious language in a little while As a matter of fact, people do not consider their beliefs one by one by one, brick by brick by brick. They always consider beliefs in tandem, or as I say, in clusters. There's no such thing as an isolated belief. There's clusters of belief and overlaps of clusters and so forth, or to change the metaphor, what Quine at Harvard calls a web of beliefs. And so you can't really change one without changing others that are affected by it and so forth. And when people consider their beliefs or what arguments they'll submit to, what evidence is good evidence, what they're going to commit their lives to, their considerations will be governed by those kinds of presuppositional matters. And so one of the things you're going to see as we go through the seminar is that presuppositions have a determinative function for Michael Martin, but also for us. Secondly, I would like you to note that transcendental argument may be used to prove our Christian presuppositions. Transcendental arguments are used to prove Christian presuppositions. I don't believe that evidential arguments by themselves will prove the presuppositions. Now, if you know what a presupposition is, you realize what I've just said is virtually true by definition. You can't have evidence prove your presuppositions because it's your presuppositions that determine what is evidence and how the evidence is to be collated and brought together and what kinds of conclusions you should draw and what you should emphasize and things of that nature. So when I talk about proving Christianity, and I believe we can prove Christianity to be true, the kinds of arguments that I'll be looking at or endorsing for your consideration are transcendental ones. To put it very simply, a transcendental argument takes account of the preconditions for the intelligibility of something. What would have to be true in order for this statement to make sense? And that will be distinguished later when we get to the... I'm not here talking about what would have to be the case in order for me to explain in a causal way how this happens. Or even to prove, you know, from independent considerations that this is true. The transcendental question is, well, given that this is true or knowable, what else would have to be the case in order to make sense of that? And so a presuppositional argument that is transcendental in its form can be said to argue from the impossibility of the contrary. Since only the teaching of the Bible or Christian theism can make sense out of what you're looking at, those who deny Christian theism, it turns out, make impossible even the standards by which we are arguing with one another. How many of you here will be familiar with my debate with Gordon Stein? Okay, so I can be fairly quick about this. Just to rehearse for you, I realize it was a 2.5-3 hour debate, whatever. It was a long period of time, but you can whittle down the skeleton of my argument very simply to this. The laws of logic do not comport with an atheist view of reality. They don't comport with materialism. The laws of logic don't comport with, that is, if you're a materialist, you can't, quote, make sense of the laws of logic. So here's somebody I'm debating with who is what? Arguing against Christian theism. I'm saying Christian theism is the only thing that makes sense out of the laws of logic. So I'm going to argue from the impossibility of the contrary. That is, your position, the contrary to my Christian theism, is impossible because it destroys the intelligibility of the laws of logic. Okay, so I argue that the laws of logic are incompatible with, do not comport with, the atheistic worldview. Nevertheless, argument and debate requires the laws of logic. Can't debate without laws of reasoning and, you know, how you distinguish valid from invalid, you know, patterns of thought and so forth. And so by coming to the debate, Dr. Stein assumed the laws of logic, which themselves assume the Christian worldview. So to put it very simply, by coming to the debate, he lost it. Now, you know, you can't stand up in front of 400 people and just, you know, say it like that and have them, and you sit there and go, you know, that's right. In case you want to lay that out. Maybe I can't even say that to you as an intelligent apologist like you all. We've got to think these things through. But that's a transcendental form of argument. I wasn't trying to show even how God makes laws of logic, whatever that would mean, or what the laws of logic are in terms of the thoughts of God or the patterns of God's thought, or how we know the laws of logic. I wasn't trying to prove one set of laws versus another set of laws. I wasn't preferring Aristotelian to Boolean interpretation. That is really irrelevant. Those are the sorts of questions that unbelievers sometimes come back and say, well, you haven't answered all the questions about logic, so we don't have to answer all the questions. It can be a growing field. There can be developing knowledge of logic. The point is, on your worldview, there's no logic to develop because it just doesn't fit in. Okay, so one thing I want you to look for is how presuppositions keep determining, keep functioning in a determinative way, the arguments. Secondly, note that the transcendental argument may be used to prove Christian theism. And then a third thing that we'll keep noting here is that evidentialism provides a way of escape for the unbeliever. And again, don't misconstrue what I'm saying. Evidentialists don't intend to provide a way of escape. It's not like, you know, they're getting together unbelievers and saying, look, we're going to tank it here. We're going to give you a way to avoid our argument. I mean, no, they don't want to do that. And in many cases, they don't think that they are doing that. One of the real values of going to an intelligent unbeliever like Michael Martin is letting evidentialists put their best stuff up against him to see just, you know, how good it is. Now, I'm still going to criticize him when he gets down on the evidence, mind you, all right? Because I'm going to try to show that he's got his pre-commitments and that he has his biases and yet he's not reasoning very clearly and so forth. But evidentialists need to realize that if you're not going to get to the presuppositional determinative function and use transcendental considerations, that you do leave, you know, the back door unlocked for people to escape your arguments every time. Real quickly, most evidentialists, in fact, all that I'm aware of, will say that their arguments show very probably that Jesus rose from the dead, taking it down, very probably. But if what you say to someone is that he probably rose from the dead, you're also saying what? There's some minimal probability.
He probably ascended to heaven, probably not.
The whole thing is a matter of probability, so all Christian theology then is weakened by that. But I want you to see there's a downside to this probability.
It shows the truth that it doesn't exist.
It's quite possible that it didn't happen.
Yeah,
that's
exactly right. So what you're saying is we think most of the evidence shows that he rose from the dead, but we're conceding that some might show that he didn't. Now, given the choice, what do you think the unbeliever is going to stand with? He's going to go with what you think is most probable, or is he going to say, hey, if there's any way out, I'm taking it. So I'm out that back door. Yes, I grant that you've got some interesting arguments for the resurrection, but it's also, there's some probability that he didn't, and it's that probability that I think is the most important. This last weekend I used as an analogy, many people seem to understand and pick up on it. You've noticed how the President of the United States, not just the sitting one, all presidents do this, at least in my lifetime, but the sitting President of the United States, like others, you know, when a problem, some criticism is directed to them, some accusation, they have a tendency to decide whether it's important or not, or credible or not, on the basis of whether it advances their particular political cause. You know, are we supposed to believe that all the Democrats on one side of an issue, or all the Republicans on the other side of the issue, that only rationality applies to one of those groups? And the group that says, that's not really an important issue, you know, and the other group says, no, that's a very important issue, that it's rationality that separates them? Not likely. You know, when the president has something that's going to do him great political damage, what does he do? He brings out the spin doctors and the damage control boys, and when you ask him publicly, he'll say, oh, yeah, they always say things like that. Okay. Any important questions now, you know? I'm overdoing it, but you get this kind of, oh, that's not important.
Well, unbelievers do that too. You know, we bring all this really good historical evidence. They'll say, yeah, but then again, the dead don't rise, and there's a whole lot of evidence that cadavers don't resuscitate. So, yeah, I have to agree, you've got some interesting stuff there about the Apostle Paul and 500 witnesses and all that, but nevertheless, I think the most important evidence is this over here. So how you evaluate probabilities, what you think are the important questions, what you think are the standards for resolving disagreements, what you think are the anomalies that call for resolution, all those things are determined by presuppositions, not by evidence per se. So I'm going to try to let Michael Martin be an illustration of that for you. I don't want him to escape out the back door, but I do want you to know that if we only left things at the level of some of these evidential arguments, at least you can see an intelligent man has a way to say, hey, I'm not even touched. You know? You're not pushing me by those kind of considerations. And so, to come back to my intention to teach presuppositionalism, we want to show that the unbeliever doesn't have a place to stand. You know, that he doesn't have, like, a little bit of choice in this matter, but that if he's going to be rational, that he's going to have to admit the Christian worldview. And the only way we know the Christian worldview is through the grace and the revelation of our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, so these are three themes that I hope you'll pick up on. And then I have some things I want to say about Michael Martin in the process of going through all of our details, too. So I'm going to put three up on the board, but I really have, 7 or 8 things. Listed, but I'm going to group them together to make it more memorable for you. And the one is kind of a throwaway consideration. But today I do want you to see that Michael Martin is not always accurate in his scholarship. Now, is there any value in doing that, or am I just kind of being nasty, you know, so I appear at a public debate and point out, you know, this guy makes mistakes. Well, I do too. So what's the big deal? Well, it's important here because you have to remember, this man is being promoted as a professor of philosophy. And I have some appreciation for why people outside the field who maybe don't have PhDs and so forth go a little gaga about that. Philosophy can be intimidating, very abstract, call for a lot of hard thinking, logic, and so forth. And what happens in the general public is people tend to think, well, he's a professor of philosophy. And look at how big that book is. Yeah, he says this. Who am I to dispute with him? Well, so for that purpose alone, I'm going to say, hey, don't be intellectually bullied. You have the right to dispute with him. He's not automatically right. In fact, I'm going to give you some rather, you know, I think, real. It's one of these things, the bloopers, you don't want to show up at the end of the season. People, run this back. You remember that Michael Martin said the following? I'm going to give you a few of those just to show you that this fellow is not always at the best in terms of scholarship. So he shouldn't be intimidating to you. So that's the only reason for that. But the three major things I want you to see about him is that he is not critical of his own assumptions. Okay, he's not critical of his own assumptions, and I'm going to try to point out some rather blatant biases that are there, his failure to even look at certain things he takes for granted, and that he's even willing to go to extremes to protect his presupposed atheism. I have a couple that I think are really surprising, especially for an academically trained philosopher. Even I was surprised when I ran across them. And I was like, boy, I tell you, he is really desperate to hold on to his atheism if he's willing to do a couple of things I'm going to show you. So he's not critical of his own assumptions. Secondly, he begs the question without an epistemological theory to back it up. He begs the question without an epistemological theory to fall back upon. And then finally, he doesn't even consider the strongest case against his presupposed atheism. He doesn't consider the strongest case against his atheistic presuppositions. Now, in connection with this last theme about Michael Martin, we will look at certain illustrations or facets of the transcendental argument for God's existence, which are addressed by him.
Now let me explain. I haven't contradicted myself. He does not have any conception of how the transcendental argument even comes together. It's not forward. In fact, in a minute, we're going to look at something where the subheading of the section screams at you, he's read Van Til. And then you read the section, and he doesn't come anywhere close to understanding what the Van Tilian argument is. Okay? So, I mean, that's interesting to me because in form of words, it's like he's right up against it, and he's almost like, how could you not consider this? You know? And yet, that's not even close. There are aspects of transcendental presuppositional argumentation that he takes up, but not in the context of a transcendental challenge. So that along the way, in terms of certain minor evidential arguments and what he thinks are throwaway considerations about morality and so forth, he'll bring up things like a list that I made when I was reading. He does look at the transcendental argument against naturalism, the transcendental argument about consciousness, about the objectivity of moral law, the challenge of skepticism against objective knowledge. He does discuss the possibility of the innate knowledge of God and so forth. He even looks at paradigmatic analysis with Thomas Kuhn and so forth. So along the way in the book, I mean, this guy's not just ignorant. He does, it's like he backs into things which if he just stopped looking at it and say, oh, this is a transcendental argument. But the way he backed into it, he's treating it in an evidential way or as though there's some kind of, you know, theoretical considerations outside of one's presuppositions by which you look at this. What I'm saying is he doesn't approach it clear-headedly as, well, this is a challenge that we couldn't make sense out of anything apart from the Christian worldview. But he nevertheless talks about certain things that you'll hear me use in my public debates and so forth. And so I do want to take a look at them. Even though they're not contextually and strongly presented, nevertheless, does he have something that he could use against us if we were to use those arguments? All right, so we filled the board, so that means I have to stop this.
Dr. Munson?
Yes, sir.
In the smaller book, is that what he's referring to when he refers to the divine command theory? It's kind of a transcendental...
Yes. And we're going to get into that today in terms of the larger book. He offers his refutation of that. You decide whether he, you know, successful in refuting it. But he offers the consideration that atheism does not lead to moral relativism. And he says, now it would if you hold to a divine command theory of ethics. But of course, that's a, you know, a theory you can't hold to academically or philosophically. And that's exactly right. That's one of the things we would be inclined to argue. Say that, you know, listen, if your atheism is true, I'm not saying you can't live a moral life. I think that's a mistake for us to try to say that to people. Because they are made in the image of God. Sometimes atheists live pretty decent lives outwardly. They're nice to their children. They don't always rob banks and so forth. But what we can say is you can't make sense out of objective moral principles given your atheism. And to that, even though he doesn't approach it in quite the way that I'm going to present it transcendentally, he does address that kind of issue. So, I don't know whether it's five or six illustrations that I just gave you. We'll be looking at those along the way.
Dr. Munson?
Yeah.
I noticed that Gordon Stein endorsed the book, and it was published after your debate with him. Do you know if he's heard, Mr. Martin has heard that debate or not?
I'm not aware of whether he has or not. No. I just assumed that he not before I debate him. Because it's always, this is just in terms of debate strategy, it's always better for your opponent to come in and think, well, I don't have to do a whole lot of work. This guy's going to be, you know, a piece of cake. Yeah, most of the people the atheists we have on tape that I've debated, I think have both made that mistake. And not because it's me, but I mean, anybody who's been trained similarly, I mean, they had no idea what they were going to be dealing with. And assumed that he did the same. I mean, the fact that he has written an entire book. And this is one of my opening criticisms. I've told some of you who I have talked to about this book already. And when I opened this book, I read the first line and I closed it. I said, that's it. The guy has begged the question already. And at that first opening line, well, I've told you that. Let's look at it. If you look at the introduction, page 3, if I open this up, right? He says, non-belief in the existence of God is a worldwide phenomenon. Close the book and say, no, it isn't. Because there's not one atheist in the world.
Now, I realize I'm condensing a lot of apologetics, and maybe some of you want to see that worked out. You see, he has the right to disagree with that claim, and God would think he writes a big book. He should deal with that claim, right? But he doesn't have the right to open his book by saying it isn't true. But as you'll see, I trust all of you have read it. I have to take that for granted. This is a seminar. As you've read through the book, you've noticed he doesn't even consider that as a hypothesis. You know? Again, I'm not going to say, I said it so I'm right, and that, you know, it's got to be right. But the point is, my claim is, and I think most of you here and many Christians like us, our claim is, no, there isn't one atheist in all the world. They all know God. Mm-hmm. And they all know him very clearly. And they all know him so clearly that they're without excuse. And that therefore they're guilty of suppressing what they know so very well. See, that really affects your apologetics. When I go to defend the faith with somebody, I'm not looking at trying to get him information so he can finally make a decision one way or another. I'm trying to tear the mask off that he's pretending he doesn't know these things are true. And so I'm going to try to pull the rug out from under him, right? I'm going to go and say, well, you say these are your presuppositions, what would follow from them, and so forth. And then when he says, well, but I do know things, I'm sure. Gordon Stein, maybe not everyone here is aware that after I debated Gordon Stein, he, as atheists are wont to do, well, Christians too, I don't want to be mean about this, but he wanted to publish something, you know, to get down and print, you know, how he had slain this theist, right? Well, somebody who read what he wrote about the debate that I knew sent it to me and he said, I thought you might want to see this. Well, I mean, he didn't get the argument even close, you know, not even close. And so then I'm thinking, you know, I'm praying, what should I do? What's the wisest approach? And I finally wrote to him and I said, look, I realize you don't want to be needled by people. And so maybe you don't want to consider this. But I said, just in case it's of interest to you, I just thought I'd point out that isn't the argument that I used. Here's what the argument is, you know. Well, anyway, that it turns out he was someone who wanted to keep it up. I'm sure he felt very badly about the debate, not that he would admit it. But he wanted me to stay on the line. He wanted to keep hammering. So anyway, we had maybe 6 months or so of dialogue. May have been longer, back and forth. Well, he finally got to the place where he realized what I was claiming. I don't know how long it took. But then it was almost like, you've got to be kidding. Because I said, you know, given your principles, you can't even balance your checkbook or drive your car. Well, and he writes back, he goes, but I do balance my checkbook and drive my car. But you see, that is a refute presuppositionalism. That's just what I wanted. And I said, exactly. So you do know this God that I'm talking about. And because you know this God, you balance your checkbook and you drive your car and you observe the uniformity of nature and the laws of mathematics and all those sorts of things. Okay, so the claim of the presuppositionalist is there is no atheist in this world. There are people who profess atheism.
Don't we get into the problem with this view of religious language in the first line? I mean, the fact is that we could say that that first statement is true based on our presuppositions as well. We could say that non-belief in God as the world of the system is.
That's right. Because there are two things.
But they're
things.
Going against what is actually true in their own mind.
Yes. What we want to say is there's two things going on inside the unbeliever. One is his consciously worked out theories by which he tries to make atheism look good. And the other is his knowledge of his Heavenly Father by which he's running away and trying to protect himself from judgment. So given that both those things are going on, we could say, oh yeah, there are a lot of people that profess atheism all around the world. And so that statement, in that sense, you could read that line and say, yeah, I know what he's getting at. But you see, I'm going back and I'm going to be a little more picky because even though I could interpret that is, there is an interpretation under which this sentence is true. You all understand that language. Philosophers love to talk that way. There is some value to it. They're not just being, you know, part of your long. There is an interpretation by which truth could be assigned to that sentence. However, if you look at it and consider it more in depth, you have to ask yourself, why doesn't he make clear that's his interpretation? Because if he made clear that's his interpretation, then he'd be forced to argue with what? The claim that everybody knows God.
I've already wandered from my map anyway, so let's just take a look at this real quickly. Look at page 264. I've given you a thumbnail analysis of what presuppositionalism holds, and you know that what I'm saying is that people who profess to be atheists nevertheless have faith in God. So you come to page 264, as I did, by the way, not systematically. Sometimes you just kind of thumb around. I was getting ready to read, some of this in preparation for the seminar. We went through and I said, what? And I looked at that heading, and that's when I said, great, this guy has some idea of what we believe, and he's going to attack it, right? Could an atheist have faith in God? And then you read the section, and you go, what a disappointment. That had nothing to do with what I thought I was going to do. So, again, what I'm getting at is, Michael Martin should know to draw that distinction between atheism as a profession, atheism as a belief. And yet nowhere in the book do you get anywhere close to a consideration, a serious consideration of that. And that's what I think is significant.
Well, that's interesting, especially in the opposite preface when he's talking about grandfather or something like that.
Yeah.
He makes very clear that what he's talking about is a religious faith.
He had every opportunity, to consider this. And along the way, as I've indicated, it's not on the board, but as I've indicated, there are some transcendental kinds of considerations, and yet he never turns it around to a full-orbed opponent that he's going to have to finally deal with. And yet he's making every effort. How much of this book is footnotes? Look at this. A good portion of this book, and I say that not to his discredit. That's one that's, I don't have a lot of respect for him at the end, now that I've read his argumentation and so forth. But I do respect the fact that he's made the effort to read the stuff. He knows a lot of the people. He knows some of the stuff that I didn't know about. And I'm supposed to, it's supposed to be my field. So, good. I commend him for trying to do that. But that's what makes it so suspicious. That here's somebody who's made an effort almost to flaunt how many footnotes he can put out there, how many books he's familiar with, and how many authors he's read, how many arguments he's going to put down systematically, one after another, boom, 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 boom. And us poor presuppositionalists are left standing over in the corner saying, why didn't you ever get to us, Mike? Is it because, it's not for social reasons, I assure you, because some of the people he considers here, no one takes seriously. It's not like they have big, strong philosophical movements behind them, so that wasn't the principle of selectivity. And he didn't choose on the basis of which are the longest standing arguments. He's got some very contemporary stuff, right up to Wittgensteinian fideism and Alvin Plantinga's reformed epistemology. That's in his, so that's not the principle. Now I'm playing this out so you all have an appreciation of what I'm getting at. That first line is a killer giveaway. How is it he doesn't guard himself by saying profession of atheism is worldwide? It's because I don't think he's even considered the alternative.
Would this relate, Dr. Bonson, to your first point about him not being critical of his own assumptions?
That's right. That's right. It's very good. I'm glad Bill's doing something that all of you should be doing. Keep referring to the themes that we're seeing and say, oh yeah, I see. That shows that he's not being critical of his own assumptions. He's got his presuppositions, and then the second one about Michael Martin says he's begging a question about them, and on top of it, he doesn't have an epistemological theory. He admits he doesn't have an epistemological theory to fall back on, to defend what he takes for granted. And then he doesn't even consider the strongest case against his atheistic presuppositions. And in seeing these things about him, again, we're going to learn that presuppositions have the determining function in an argument, that the way we prove Christianity is by transcendental considerations, and that the evidential considerations, if they are not put in the context of worldview apologetics, presuppositional apologetics, without intending to provide a way of escape for any unbeliever who's intelligent enough to get around things. I've been anticipating a lot of where we're going to be going, and that's okay, because it's supposed to be casual anyway. But I give you a real easy illustration of how there's a way around what the evidentialist wants to present. The evidentialist presents evidence that a miracle took place, or what you would call a miracle took place. You have to understand that any unbeliever, if you don't challenge his underlying naturalism, any unbeliever has a way around that. Doesn't have to be touched by it. And that's one thing I give him credit for. Michael Martin sees that right away. I mean, he seizes on that one. And how is it that it's so easy to get around? Sometimes when I have brothers in the Lord who are saying that they prefer evidentialism to presuppositionalism, you know, and we're having a friendly conversation back and forth about that, I'll say, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you throw your evidential arguments at me, and I'll play the part of a hopefully intelligent unbeliever. We'll see how well they do, okay? They always bite, because they always think they can do better than the last guy. That's all right. So they'll start out and they'll say something like, well, okay, I would begin by arguing that the New Testament is textually reliable. And so, and rather than fighting that, I say, oh, yeah, I think so. In fact, as an unbeliever, I could say that it's probably the best attested text of the ancient world. And they look at me and they go, really? Yeah, no problem. Okay, well, but in the pages of the New Testament, we have the presentation of a man who rose from the dead. We have a resurrection claim. And so now they're expecting this, we're going to get the opposition. I'll say, oh, yeah, I grant that too. They'll say, wait a minute. You'll grant that the body of Jesus was actually dead, not just appeared to be dead, actually dead, and then it lived again? I say, oh, yeah. They'll say, well, then you should become a Christian. I'll say, oh, no. All that tells us is that there are strange things in the universe that we haven't understood yet.
That's how it is.
How long did that take me? 2.5 minutes? But you see, if you're an intelligent atheist, you don't have to worry about these popular apologists that the Christian church just, you know, we go gaga over these guys. And while you're all going gaga over it, I'm sitting at SC in the philosophy department talking to people who don't care a twit about that, because they realize in terms of the fundamental philosophical issues, they could even grant, if they wanted to, and not that they all do, but the point is, they could grant that Jesus was dead and then he lived again. And isn't that bizarre? And maybe one day enough of these things will happen, we'll be able to study the circumstances under which and have law-like explanations for it. And so I don't have to give up my naturalism. I don't even have to say Jesus is God. You know, and they can say things like, well, Lazarus rose from the dead. You know, and our comeback, well, Jesus made him rise from the dead. You say, well, yeah, according to what Jesus said. But for all we know, Jesus said this, or his followers put it in his mouth, after the same strange thing that happened to Jesus happened to Lazarus. You say, but that isn't what the text says. Yeah, right, but I'm not committed to believing what the text says. I'm just committed to saying someone very early on said that. And so all those evidential arguments that, don't take me as contradicting myself, all those evidential arguments, which as a matter of fact, we as Christians read and we say, that's right, and it strengthens our faith. And it can strengthen our faith, but those arguments that strengthen our faith do not make someone who is arguing against the faith come to faith. There's a big difference. Well, I've been talking long enough. Do you want to ask any questions? We're going to take a break in a moment here. Anything about what we've considered so far?
Okay, just one comment on your debate with Mr. Tabash as well.
Okay.
It didn't seem like either Dr. Stein or Mr. Tabash got the picture. At the end of the day, it's like they're passing in the night and didn't comprehend what it was.
Well, that's certainly true in the case of Stein, because like I say, it took a number of letters back and forth before it finally stung him what I was saying. Not that he was willing to believe it, but I mean, he would have thought at the debate itself, he would have said, you got to be out of your mind to think that, you know, and here's why. But I mean, he just never caught on to what was happening. And much of the Tabash debate, that seems to be true. But as I've gone over the tape, it seems to me at one point, he may just in passing realize he doesn't have a ground ethically for what he's doing. But as soon as he does that, of course, you're standing in front of 1,100 people. He's not going to say, oh, man, I'm going to have to rethink this one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I get the impression that he was stunned just a little, but then he went right back to his same old stuff. As you can see, he just keeps giving the same answers over and over again. What are you thinking of?
There's two points that I thought of. He kept saying you were trying to defend your view based on an inerrant Bible, so you wanted to attack the Scripture.
Yeah, right.
So that's why it was during the question and answer period when they brought up Matthew.
Well, opening argument, I told him that given his worldview, Hitler had every right to do whatever Hitler wanted to do. And that on my worldview, I would condemn what Hitler did and have a good reason for it, but that he really gives, you know, I said, you have no basis for condemning anything. And that did seem to bother him later in the debate at one point. But you're also right that he thought he could make this a debate about the existence of God, since I said I'm committed to the Christian God, the biblical God. He thought he could turn it into a debate about inerrancy details. And, of course, that's one of those things where you're trying to teach debate tactics to people. You see, I hope I did it well here. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but that's one of the things you've got to be really set on in a debate is I'm not going to let him control where this debate's going. And so he says things. I mean, at one point, I finally had to tell him how stupid the stuff about the text of Scripture is, finally, just so people wouldn't think I'm trying to evade it. But the point is, he's saying all these things that are so easy to answer in terms of evidence, but if I would have gotten off on that, then everybody would have assumed he had the right to appeal to evidences pro and con. And my whole point was, you can't argue scientifically at all, given your worldview. So I had to kind of let him throw those away, and I wanted to keep bringing him back to, you can't make any sense out of science or of morality. Okay, well, apart from those debates, anything in this opening discussion you'd like to bring before you give a chance to take a break?
When the evidentialists hear the debates against their method, what are their... I can recall your debate with Sproul when you were talking about probability, and he wasn't getting that.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of what are the strengths on the other side. But...
Well, if you mean by evidentialism self-conscious, non-presuppositional evidentialism, I don't think there are any strengths on the other side. Okay. In one sense, the question could be, what do you think are the toughest arguments they have to offer? Problem is, even the toughest arguments, I have an account for, I think. But an evidentialist who doesn't understand what a presuppositionalist is saying might say, well, but in the Bible, evidences are presented, and they're supposed to be impressive. But I don't have any problem with that, because I think all men are made in the image of God, and when they say, oh, yeah, well, cadavers could rise, they're playing big games. That's big-time intellectual parlor game stuff, you know? Because they're made in the image of God. I know that if they really took seriously Jesus rose from the dead, there'd be a sense of fear and trembling inside. They'd say, oh, this universe is not as, compatible with my naturalism as I thought. Okay. What I'm saying, though, is that the outward response of an atheist can deal with the evidentialist arguments very easily. And that's why I have to push to say, well, you may say you can pass off that as just there's a natural explanation. But now let's talk about what makes a natural explanation possible. It turns out you can't escape even at that. But anyway, you're asking, what do the evidentialists say on the other side? My assessment is that generally, evidentialists who argue with presuppositionalists always turn us into fideists, and then they dismiss fideism. And they think that they've done it. They have not really understood the transcendental force of the presuppositionalist argument. There's so few that do, it's hard to answer your question. But to the extent that they do understand that, what they'll say is, like I already indicated, but these evidences nevertheless should make people believe, and they do reinforce our faith. And how could that be? If you're not really a relativist, if you're not a fideist, then you've got to grant this evidence points to something. But as I've said, we already believe the evidence points to something. The question is, how do you deal with people who try to blunt the pointing? And how do you take that on?
Well, they usually jump on the common ground idea that we believe the Bible's true, but, you know, they say that makes the question, so let's get on their side and talk about the history of the resurrection.
Right, right. And then you get into the whole question of what constitutes common ground in an argument. If somebody were to be perfectly consistent with this atheist profession, and I were to be perfectly consistent with my Christian profession, we wouldn't have anything we agree on. We would systematically differ with each other. And so the evidentialists will say, why then can you talk to each other? Why do arguments work and so forth? Well, the answer to that is, because we don't believe they are systematically consistent with what they profess. And since they do know God in their heart of hearts, anything is common ground. You know, as Van Til would say, the whole creation's common ground. Start anywhere you want. Talk about a cup of coffee or an opera or the latest discovery in science. Start anywhere you want. And the unbeliever cannot make sense of it. So there is common ground, but there is not professed common ground or theoretical common ground.
An evidentialist arguing with an atheist then loses before it even begins. In the sense that...
If the situation were what the evidentialist thinks that it is, you know, the men are neutral, there are brute facts, and on, yes, they've lost. But because the situation is not what evidentialists think it is, evidentialists can do good work in apologetics, effective work in apologetics, which is always what we have to point out when I've had evidentialists say, well, I've seen people come to the Lord through this argument. I'll say, well, you actually haven't seen someone come to the Lord because that happens invisibly. And it takes place by the power of the Holy Spirit. But what you meant is that God used this as a tool for bringing people to Him. I said, and I agree with that. But you see, He didn't bring them to Him through those arguments because brick by brick the facts were built up like that. It's because people made in the image of God realize they're dealing with their Creator when Jesus rises from the dead. And their judge. And God changes their heart and so forth. So I don't think people can have bad theories and still have good arguments. If I would have started there, maybe we would have cut short this conversation. You all understand that, right? People can argue. Well, people can hit home runs who don't understand the theory of swinging a bat. But I saw a guy goes to the plate and he goes, you know, when I swing a bat, it's really a Martian that's carrying the wood around for me. They say, what a bizarre view. But having that view doesn't keep him from hitting the ball out of the park.
But without presupposition, what you're really saying is you can't win or lose at the plate.
Yeah, in a sense, if you don't get to the presuppositional issue, it's always going to be kind of a standoff.
It's like the presidential debate. You ask 10 people, 5 say one guy, 5 say the other.
That's right. Or even worse, ask the guys who are in the debate, and what they'll do is they'll give you their pre-canned answer anyway.
There are more problems too. I mean, using your bat as an example, if he corks his bat, then he's obviously, he has a problem with the rules. I mean, isn't an evidentialist
corking the bat
immoral? In a sense, he's corking his bat. Isn't he saying we're going to leave God out of the picture? I mean, isn't there a moral problem with that?
Yeah. In my syllabus on apologetics, I talk about that at the very opening, about the immorality of the claim to neutrality.
Yeah, that'd be a fearful thing, I would guess. Yeah.
The sad thing is, and again, you all know evidentialist brothers and so forth, they're good Christian people. They love the Lord and they mean well. And yet, for all of their meaning well, they go out to do things which, without intention, insult the Lord. Peter says in 1 Peter 3, setting apart Christ as Lord in your hearts, be prepared to give an answer to any man who asks you. Notice the precondition of apologetics, making Christ Lord in your thinking. Set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts. And then they go out to defend the faith and they say, okay, I'm going to set aside the lordship of Christ and you set aside your atheism and let's try to neutrally approach these brute facts. Well, Jesus has already told you not to do that. Not only are you not to do it, but the Bible teaches you you can't do it. And so when you think you are, you're just being suckered into presuppositions that will destroy your argument.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.